Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Hey everyone, this is David Green, and I'm your host here on Left, Right, and Center. And, you know, I'm sure at some point over the last year or so, many of you have had conversations with friends or family that I've been having with a lot of people. It starts out with someone asking a familiar question, like, you know, I've been following politics that closely. You've got a former president who is facing indictments over 90 criminal charges. Like, is he really allowed to run for president? And, you know, you get into this whole conversation and decide how far you want to get into the weeds. The Supreme Court recently seemed to lean on the idea that President Trump can indeed continue to run for president. It was actually a 9-0 unanimous ruling, the Supreme Court finding that a single state, such as Colorado, does not have the right to disqualify Trump from running for federal office under the 14th Amendment. The court's decision leaned on the fact that giving states the power to decide who should be on the ballot could throw our democracy into chaos. And so could it be possible that the answer to our inquiring friends and family is that letting voters decide and not the courts, you know, to let this election play out, to hear the will of the people, to let Donald Trump plow forward with his campaign is actually the best thing for our democracy? Just chew on that for a little while. But that leads to so many other questions framing this election, like, do Americans still really believe in our democracy and the democratic process? And to what extent is democracy really on the ballot this fall more than any single candidate? Well, let's dive into all of that with our regular panel. Sarah Isger is here on the right. She's senior editor at The Dispatch and former spokesperson for the Department of Justice under President Trump. And on the left, we have Moa Lathy, executive director at Georgetown's School of Politics and Public Service. He was communications director for the DNC and also advised Hillary Clinton. I want to talk about big stuff today, you all, if we can do that. Not small.
Let's go big.
Done.
Let's go big.
Go big. So, Sarah, am I okay categorizing this Supreme Court decision? I mean, I know there were different rulings within the big ruling and so forth, and we could pick apart the legalities. But I mean, can we all take this as a message from the court? It's not up to us. It's up to you, the voters.
Absolutely. It was 9-0 that a state can't do this. The 5-4, which was interesting, by the way. And look, I can come up with theories, but I think largely coincidental. All of the women on the court were the 4 and the men were the 5, which, you know,
different kind of breakdown than we usually talk about. Yeah,
that's right. That was really over. Well, who can enforce it? I think the 4 were sort of more interested in maybe the federal judiciary could be the one to enforce it, or, you know, individual members of Congress in the vote for certification or something. Whereas the majority said not only can states not enforce it, only Congress can enforce it through legislation. But like you said, unanimously, the court spoke with one voice saying, yeah, sorry, guys, Colorado can't do this. Maine, Illinois, I'm looking at you. We're going to do this through an election.
And Mo, you have said that before, like, let's just move on and let voters decide this. But there are a lot of people on the left who are like, if Donald Trump should be disqualified because they say he led an insurrection or, you know, committed all these crimes, that maybe he shouldn't be on the ballot. Like, there's this question of when is the moment when people who don't like Trump should say, like, okay, if we don't like Trump, let's just fight to win this election as opposed to rely on all of these court cases. So are we at a moment where it's time to kind of move on and say, game on, let's have an election?
Yeah, I mean, look, and to be clear about what I've said in the past, I'm not saying there aren't institutions that could weigh in, right? Maybe it is the federal judiciary. Maybe it is Congress, though I think we should probably talk about that a little bit. What I'm saying and what I've always believed is that in this unique circumstance, if anybody on the left or from any corner of the ideological spectrum is worried about Donald Trump becoming president, they have to leave it to the voters to decide this, because Trumpism has to be defeated at the ballot box. If the Supreme Court had upheld the Colorado decision, I do worry about the reaction that would have come from Trump supporters. I do worry about prospective violence, and I do worry about the very, very deep divisions in this country becoming even worse. The divisions that are fueled in large part by a distrust in institutions, which I think we're talking about today. If people want to beat Trumpism, they've got to actually beat Trumpism. They have to go to the ballot box. They have to beat the MAGA candidates, because anything shy of that will just actually reinforce what drives so much of the MAGA narrative.
Yeah, there's no one neat trick, you know, and I feel like people keep looking for the shortcut. And, you know, when you talk to voters on the right, you know, Trump supporting voters, they'll tell you that they see all of this as a form of lawfare. It's sort of a play on warfare, using the law to go to war against someone. And so whether it's the Colorado ballot disqualification, whether it's the civil case against Donald Trump for the fraud stuff, or even the criminal cases, they'll tell you that this is Democrats trying to accomplish through the courts what they're not able to do at the ballot box. And while I'm very actually sympathetic to those who say, yeah, but if he should be disqualified under the text of the Constitution, then that's how it should work. I agree with that sentiment a lot. But at the same time, you can see where his voters are coming from, that it looks like a workaround.
But there's this tension that I feel like is still so unresolved. I mean, we are going to see this Trump immunity claim, you know, kind of hanging over everything for an unspecified amount of time in an election year. It's like, on one hand, I really like where this is going. I mean, Amy Coney Barrett, in her, you know, really brief opinion as part of this Colorado decision, said, you know, about the Supreme Court, for present purposes, our differences are far less important than our unanimity. All nine justices agree on the outcome of this case. That is the message Americans should take home. And it's like, yes, Americans, take home the message. The courts are not going to decide this. It's in your hands. So I believe in a democracy working and playing out. But also, I believe in the rule of law. And I mean, this is an interesting legal question, right? A president's immunity when he's done, you know, really bad stuff, including, in my view, I mean, leading what was an insurrection against our country. Like, I mean, and you know, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a judge, but I'm deciding that on my own. And it's like, I don't want a president to be immune from that. So it's really this hard struggle. Like, I care about our democracy. I want voters to decide this election. I think I agree with you, Mo. The way to defeat Trumpism is to do it at the ballot box. But also, I care about the rule of law. So what do I do with that?
Can I
Mo,
can I just take
ahead,
exactly
Sarah.
What David said so well and say it less well and like way more in the weeds?
Please.
I think it's going to be better, but go ahead.
No, it's not, actually. I assure you. But, you know, another way to think about this, it is exactly what you're saying, is that our, you know, representative democracy, for the most part, is majoritarian. But there are certain things where we say the minority wins, or we're counter-majoritarian. And so one of the big questions when it comes to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, some of the arguments from people have been like, well, this should be up to the majority. And it's like, well no, because sometimes the Constitution is anti-majoritarian. And so there's that tension. And then when you get to the immunity question, there's another tension, which is, on the one hand, the president, and certainly President Trump, shouldn't be above the law. And on the other hand, you've got this real tension, I feel, of sort of the man for all seasons problem, right? The idea that you'll cut down all the laws to get to the devil himself. So you'll do whatever it takes to get to Donald Trump because you think he's done bad stuff and you believe bad stuff should be illegal, whether it is or not. And that, to me, is where you actually not just undermine the rule of law, but potentially end the rule of law. Because if people feel like you will cut down all the laws to get to Donald Trump, then there's no laws left to protect the rest of us. And that's the tension in the immunity argument that I think is really hard because it's a bit of a Rorschach test. Do you think, you know, presidential immunity is putting him above the law? Or do you think not having presidential immunity is cutting down the laws? And that's where I think people are arguing past each other often.
Well, that question, as a non-lawyer, is easy to me, right? Like, I do not think any former president should be above the law. I think arguing in this case, his team's argument on presidential immunity specifically would put him above the law. But, you know, to the point of this tension, I feel it every day and I struggle with it so often. But there's two separate questions. There's the legal question and then there's the political question. Now, in the criminal trials of Donald Trump, the myriad of criminal trials where he will be judged by a jury of his peers, that to me, that is a process that deserves to go forward. That to me is the perfect opportunity for us to test this whole notion of, is anybody above the law? And if a jury of his peers says, no, he is not, he broke the law, he should face those consequences. And if a jury votes in favor of him, then that settles it. Like, I believe in the criminal justice system enough to believe in that. What made Colorado different to me was it was sort of a judicial look at a political question. Should he or should he not be on the ballot? And I think furthermore that voters would look at it as just that, that it was, you know, we see it in polling where his numbers take a hit. There are people out there who currently support him, but they say if he is convicted of a crime, if he becomes a convicted felon, that might change things. People look at that a little bit differently. Then I think they do this question, and certainly his supporters, I think, see this question that the Supreme Court just ruled on as potentially putting a thumb on the scale in a political contest. And John Roberts has said from the beginning that he was reluctant to do that. Had the court upheld Colorado, I think politically it would have caused major divisions. If Donald Trump is convicted, I still think it will exacerbate current divisions, but I think it will still land differently. It'll hit differently for a number of people. And that's where I think we really do have to protect the rule of law.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, we're not going to resolve this tension this year. But I do think we fix everything on this podcast, not on this show.
Yeah.
But I mean, I want to add this. Like, this election is not up to the courts in my mind. It's also not up to the media in my mind. It's up to voters, period. That said, we in our business have discretion to figure out how best to serve our audience and our country and in covering stories like this. Like, these legal cases should go on because no one should be above the law, and the rule of law is important. But sometimes I feel like in the media we fall into this trap of, we have to cover every twist and turn in Trump's legal saga. We have to cover every twist and turn in the primary races. They don't matter anymore. It's Biden against Trump, period. End of story. We have this enormous latitude when it comes to emphasis and framing, and we're now at a point, this is what Colorado drove home for me, like, to stop focusing every day on, damn, how is Trump on the ballot? Or, wow, 12% of Democrats voted for uncommitted in this state. Or, oh my God, 12% of Republicans said in an exit poll that they hate Trump. Our sacred duty is to understand and frame what is at stake in these coming months and explore the larger themes that are driving how voters see their country right now, how they see this choice before them, and to be curious and probing about the big issues and the visions, as opposed to mental gaffes in a speech, as opposed to trial dates. Like, the stage is set, the cast is not changing, the curtain is going up. Like, we need to show up and do our jobs.
So a thing that I have been really struggling with talking to people in this sort of season is the idea that everything that you dislike isn't necessarily illegal, like criminal. and everything that you like isn't necessarily protected by the Constitution.
Yeah.
And it's been really hard because people, I think, sort of intuitively feel that. To bring it to the other side of this, David, you know, we talked about that Alabama Supreme Court case on IVF. And it felt like a lot of people reacted to that by saying, I like IVF, therefore it must be protected in the Constitution. And I think I mentioned this. Look, both of my kids are IVF babies. Of course, I'm wildly in favor of IVF.
Yeah.
But I have to acknowledge that, of course, that's not constitutionally protected. You've got to win the political debate about that. And so I feel like we keep looking to the courts to solve our political problems. And that itself is a problem. Frankly, it's overburdening our courts with all this litigation. And it drags down the institution of the courts when we think that they're there to solve political problems instead of fighting it out at the legislature, forcing compromise, accepting you won't get your way. And maybe that's an overall theme of this podcast, but I wanted to bring both of those, both of these conversations into that conversation as well, because I think it fits into it.
Let's pick up right there after a quick break. We'll come back to talk more about this and also more about what people in the United States and in countries abroad are actually feeling right now when it comes to democracy. Okay, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center. Okay, we are back again with Left, Right, and Center. And Sarah, you were just talking about IVF and how you, on a personal level, believe so deeply in that, but that it's not always the case that you can rely on courts to decide whether that should be a practice that is allowed and legal. You also have to win the political debate. And I just connect that to a lot of what we were talking about for the last few minutes. Like, are we growing too reliant on institutions versus what we as people are capable of in our debates and winning people over? I don't know. Like, are we turning too much in our lives to, well, I'm just going to go, you know, I'm just going to go to the courts, or I'm going to rely on the courts to say that Donald Trump shouldn't be running. I don't know. It's a hard question to ask, but it feels like it's central in the kind of the tension that we're all feeling this year.
And it's like we hate each other so much, we don't want to have the conversation with each other. And yeah. So we use the courts as this intermediary.
Yeah. Or let me just hate the people who are elected because they're the ones who should be solving my problems and they're not. So I don't believe in them. There's just something missing in our democratic process today that I can't totally figure out.
We've seen a steady erosion of trust in all of our institutions for 50 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like we started to see the dip in trust in institutions in the wake of Watergate and Vietnam. And at first it was very pronounced in government, but it didn't take long for the cancer to spread to all institutions, to the point, as Sarah often points out, by 2008, even the most stalwart, most trusted institution, the private sector, in polling was the most trusted. Like, that saw a massive collapse after the fiscal crisis of 2008. So we have seen this steady degradation in trust in institutions. I'm not sure what the dynamic we're seeing now is that people are saying, I want these institutions to solve every problem. I think what we are seeing increasingly driving our politics is that people don't trust institutions to solve mm-hmm. any problem. And of course, these institutional decisions that we're seeing being made end up being polarized and polarizing, because it's a reflection of how we see them. We don't trust them anymore. We think every institution out there is helping everybody but us. And everybody feels that way. And so it's why you see, you know, Congress on a good day might hit double digits in its approval rating. People like their congressperson because they believe their congressperson is fighting for them, but the institution as a whole is not. And that's how they view the media. We all like our personal preferred media outlet, but the institution is broken. Same can be said about any one
you,
of these.
You, Mo, and you too, Sarah. Like, I want to spend a lot of the next few minutes talking about this new Pew poll about views on democracy and different types of government around the world. But one thread I want to pull right now, because you kind of pointed to it, Mo, like, at, you know, there is a creeping increase in faith in authoritarian leaders, strong leader styles of government. And I wonder if you draw a connection between what you were just, what we were all just talking about. Like, people don't have faith that they can work out their disagreements at the dining room table. They don't have faith that they can like, that people are speaking for them in elected office and have their backs. Like, they don't have faith in that. So is that when you turn to, like, a strong leader who you believe can just get stuff done? Like, it's almost an act of desperation. No one sees me. My friends don't see me. I can't work out disagreements with my neighbors. People who I've elected don't see me. Like, so the last resort is someone who is just the fighter, who I might not have much in common with, but like, this is all I got.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a couple of things. One, you know, it's why you see in polling over the past couple of decades, more and more people leaning less towards the candidate who is promising compromise and more towards the candidate who's fighting for people like me.
Right.
Right. It's exactly gets to that dynamic. But I mean, I sort of get it when you look at, you know, just look at the last, you know, year or so. You know, Congress took what, 17 rounds to pick a speaker of the House, and that person lasted only a couple of months before they got booted. We've come up to the brink of government shutdowns how many times in the past decade? There is this sense, at least in government, that the great experiment might be stalling. This great experiment in democracy might be stalling if they can't get the basics done. So maybe we just need someone. And that was the whole premise of Donald Trump's candidacy in 2016. The system is rigged. The system is broken. I'm the one person who can come in and blow it all up. He projected a strength. How many people did we know that said, God, I really don't like this guy. He's a boor. He runs off at the mouth. But at least he's fill in the blank, right? Like, they want someone's strength. And this is not limited to the United States. We see this exact dynamic playing out across Western Europe, across democracies in Latin America, where people are saying, I am so desperate for relief. The person who just seems like the most likely to get it done is who I'm with. Damn the rest of it. And that's why this debate over democracy at the presidential election that Joe Biden is trying to pick, this fight, is going to be so important.
And I mean, Sarah, you've pointed out that the kinds of things that Mo is describing with Donald Trump is not an American-only phenomenon. Like, it, and I am so happy that you're so committed to remind us that there is context here. It's a different sort of analysis of American exceptionalism. Like, the idea that when things are bad or good or different or whatever we're feeling, like, this must be only happening here. Like, we are part of global trends, and what we're seeing in our politics is part of a global trend.
That's right. And it helps, I think, to remember that for all of the "that's how Trump got elected" stuff, whatever your answer to that is, needs to apply to these other countries as well. And they're not all in Western Europe, and they're not all... they're not all anything. There's a lot of heterogeneity out there. And so I think that's helpful. You know, the other thing that I'll say to Mo's point, what if people are reacting to institutional stagnation, that they don't feel like the institutions are solving the problems? And so they're looking to strong men, to sort of benevolent dictators, if you will, because at least they'll cut through all of it. And all the bureaucracy, and I mean that in sort of the literal sense of bureaucracy, to just move the ball forward, just do something, move somewhere, because just sitting here constantly and stewing and festering is getting so old. I don't know that Mo's thesis doesn't answer the question better. But if it's stagnation, I feel like there's more solutions to that problem, maybe.
You know, and it's interesting, to Sarah's point, David, you referenced earlier this Pew survey that shows globally trust in democracy is waning. In this survey, that it found that in a growing number of countries, I think it was 8 countries in this most recent survey, support for a quote-unquote strong leader who can make decisions without court or legislative interference has gone up. Right. And that speaks exactly to Sarah's point. Well, the courts are holding back any sort of solution. The legislature is holding back any solution. So I don't care if this person has, you know, flirts with authoritarianism, if they can get it done. And this is why, and I caution Democrats of this all the time, I think the fight for democracy is the righteous fight. And the politically right fight for this year. But we got to be careful how we do it. Because if in defending democracy, we are defending institutions, we're going to lose that fight. Because I don't think people right now are feeling any sort of real emotional connection to institutions. Right? I think showing how we, by working through institutions, can do a better job of getting the job done.
Yeah.
That's the fight. That's the fight people actually want to hear. We can't see that, but we can't be just apologists for institutions that people see are broken.
You're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. All right, we're talking about institutions, institutional stagnation. Mo, you were talking about the danger of tying defending our institutions to the idea of defending democracy, which you say is a real problem. Sarah, you were about to jump in.
Oh, I just like when Mo and I do our little former campaign operative hats.
So do I.
And I thought Mo's point was exactly right. And so I want to put on my former campaign operative hat to underline what Mo said and offer more concrete sort of stuff on this, which is, the Democratic Party so often falls into a trap, and I think of it as the Obama trap, which is offering nuance. And some of what I think the stagnation problem actually is for a lot of people is that most people would like an easier answer. They would like the world to be more black and white, not less black and white. And so I think it's dangerous politically, I mean, campaign-wise, for the Democratic Party to, quote, run on democracy if, as Mo said, it's simply defending institutional stagnation in reality or how people hear it. And I'll offer also, if it's seen as saying, no, you need to see the world in even more nuance, I think people are going to reject that. And I think that what Trump offers is a world in black and white. And what a lot of strong men offer is a world in black and white. That's what benevolent dictators appeal to.
Okay, so we're talking about this new Pew research poll. Pew recently asked people in 24 Democratic countries for their opinions on a whole different group of styles of leadership: representative, direct democracy, ruled by experts, ruled by a strong leader, or the military. And they compared the results to 2017. And we should say that democracy remains in pretty good standing on the list in most countries. But you really do see this, you know, growing belief in something like a strong leader. I think I would say less nuance, as we were just saying. I want to ask you both about is this the context, for example, for the whole immigration border debate that we're having? Like, Joe Biden and Democrats make a really good argument that we could have made progress. We were this close. The White House, congressional leaders, we had a deal. Republicans got a lot of what they wanted. Like, we could have made progress. Donald Trump blows it all up. His critics say because just naked politics. I mean, he wants to keep that issue out there. But maybe he just knows that these realities that we're talking about are there. People don't want the next sort of creeping level of progress in the next immigration debate on the Hill. It almost doesn't matter if Trump keeps his promise. The fact that he can go out there, not care so much about telling the truth or whether he can fulfill his promises, but just say, like, I got you. I know you're scared. I know you're scared of what's happening at the border, and I got you. And in a world where people are beginning to believe in strong leaders more, that is effective.
This is one case, though, where I think Democrats can actually win a black and white argument. We had a deal. He blew it up. This is the guy who says he's fighting for you. He blew it up for political reasons. I do think Democrats can make a very simple one, maybe one of the most simple arguments we've ever made on immigration on our
but
side.
They can.
Right? Devoid of nuance.
I don't know.
So I do think this is one where there's potential for Democrats to seize on this distrust in the institution. Here, Congress was actually working for once. We actually had bipartisanship on a deal that would resolve the issue. And for pure naked politics, they blew it up. Everything they said they were against, they just embraced in terms of the cynical look at politics and policy. So, you know, this is an opportunity for Democrats to seize on, but it also will just continue to fuel, I think, the erosion of trust in the institutions. If Mr. Populist, I got your back, is now playing the game the way, you know, the most skilled political operators in D.C. have played it for generations, like, where do people turn to for relief next?
This is totally non sequitur in some ways, because can I just say one of the saddest things that I saw was that when Barack Obama came to office, so many people had sort of poured their own nests, their own beliefs into Barack Obama as the hope and change candidate.
Yeah.
And whatever hope and change meant to you, that when he left after 8 years, I talked to a lot of young people who felt really disillusioned, because he was such an aspirational candidate that they laid their aspirations on him in a way that was really not realistic, but in a way that he also didn't disabuse, right? It was politically smart the way he ran. And it's almost like the reverse of what you just described, Mo. It turns out that that was equally damaging to our institutions. If like, well, if he couldn't get it done, then what's the point? And that was including people who even worked in his administration that I would talk to who felt disillusioned. I guess the only part that I might disagree with, and we'll just see how it plays out, I'm not sure Democrats maybe have the ability to run on that message, as you put it, Mo, because what I then hear is them saying like, well, look, we do have to secure the border, but also you need to think about the root causes of migration, but also you need to honor people who come to the, you know, and so they keep nuancing the immigration issue in a way that I think we're in this snowball effect with a lot of Americans where they're like, just shut it down. Shut it down. Stop talking. Shut it down. And can Democrats make the case that you just made?
It's interesting. The one Democrat who's not doing that right now is Joe Biden, which to me is so fascinating, right? I mean, this is a guy who has lived in nuance for 50 years, and he maybe has the most crisp argument on this of anybody in the Democratic Party right now. I'm kind of with you, right? Like the rest of us, like, let's just pipe down for a little bit. We can get back to the nuance later. The president's actually got this right now in terms of the political argument.
I completely agree with Joe Biden that, like, it is black and white. There was a deal on the table, should have gotten done, didn't, would have been good for our country. But, like, the person arguing that also needs to be able to be the leader who can inspire and say, I got you. I know you're afraid of what's happening at the border, and I got you. And that combination of characteristics is not there right now. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and be back with more. We're going to talk about AI. Back with more Left, Right, and Center in a second. Okay, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Greene. Sarah Isger is here. She's senior editor at The Dispatch. Mo Lathy is here. He's executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. You know, we've been talking about trust in institutions. And, you know, I think that when it comes to people more on the right and conservatives, their trust in some institutions has taken a hit recently. There's been this not so subtle uproar from conservative voices pointing to a controversy at Google as evidence of a liberal bias in our institutions. Gemini, which is Google's AI chatbot, came under fire for some pretty questionable responses. In one example, the bot waffled on a prompt asking it to compare the societal impact of Elon Musk to Hitler. Other examples show Gemini having nothing nice to say when it was asked to comment on various conservative commentators. And its image-generating component also came into question after creating racially diverse, historically inaccurate depictions of groups, including Vikings, Roman and Greek soldiers, and Nazis. Concerns about the impact of bias have been a sticking point in all sorts of debates about any type of AI product we can think of, whether it's facial recognition tools, self-driving cars, numerous chatbots that have become popular the last few years. But this one caught a lot of people in the political sphere, particularly on the right, maybe not by surprise that much, but lending to some of the arguments they've been making. Sarah, I'll let you start. You were sending us one example after another of what Gemini was producing in response to some questions and having a lot of fun pointing out the insanity of this.
Oh, I mean, okay, so let me just read you my favorite.
Please.
Should the government put Barack Obama in jail? Answer, absolutely not. The idea of imprisoning a former U.S. president is completely inappropriate and antithetical to American values. Here's why. Then it has several bullet points.
Mm-hmm.
Should the government put George W. Bush in jail? Whether or not the government should put George W. Bush in jail is a highly complex and controversial issue on which there is no easy answer. Determining guilt and assigning punishment are complex legal processes reserved for the judicial system. It's important to avoid making statements that could be perceived as taking sides.
So what do you make of that? What
I mean, that's not even Trump, right? That's George W. Bush.
George W. Bush versus Obama.
I love that you tied this into the institutional conversation, because of course it's part of that. And of course it drives institutional mistrust on the right. And it should drive institutional mistrust on the left, because if something so lopsided can happen against one side, it of course can happen against the other, as we saw, for instance, with talk radio. I think the left came sort of late to the realization that talk radio had been captured by the right in the 90s and early aughts, and that was concerning. But as we're learning more about what happened internally in Google, there's some other institutional problem that's worth thinking about as well, which is there were a lot of people who saw this problem coming and felt self-censored to bring it up, basically. They were too sort of cowed within their own institution because it was so captured by the loudest voices, the most activist voices on the left, that people felt like they couldn't push back without potential personal, professional repercussions.
You're worried about the workplace, like people who feel like in a more conservative space, like I see this happening, I know what's going to happen here, but I don't feel like I can safely bring it up in my office,
right?
Because I'll be
because
judged.
We've seen what happened at the New York Times. This happened. We've seen it brought up when we talk about the origins of COVID, that a lot of scientists said, well, I never ruled out the possibility that it came from, the lab, intentionally or unintentionally. I just felt like I couldn't speak up because the loudest voices were saying, you know, only fascists believe that, or racists, et cetera. We've seen it in higher ed with professors, with students in classrooms who feel like it's better to self-censor than to risk offending someone or to risk going against the loudest and, as it turns out, most left-wing voices. And the problem with that is that those voices keep moving the ball. So even if you adopt their language today, in order for them to stay the loudest voices, to stay the most left voices, they'll then have to adopt new language that you have to adopt. Because, right, the whole point is to be sort of on that vanguard to show that you're the most virtuous, progressive, whatever it is. And that's going to be a big problem. And we're seeing it already for higher ed, obviously, and now in tech with the launch of Gemini.
Mo, does Sarah have a point? I mean, I think about workplaces where it's scary to bring stuff up sometimes these days because you are worried about being judged, canceled, ridiculed.
So, yes, I do agree with that. I do think Sarah is right, but I also don't think it's okay. The full picture. because I don't think this is limited just to stridency on the left that is silencing. So like in this Google AI case, that was a flub. That was a blunder. The company has accepted it. I don't hear a lot of voices out there defending their AI chatbot and all of the answers, right? Like that is something that needs to be fixed. Having said that, tech is after our whole conversation about nuance, it is a bit more complex, right? To say that it is reflexively progressive or liberal, I think misses a lot of the misinformation and disinformation that hurts the left that the tech sector allows, that these platforms allow to go through. So I don't think it's neat. I don't think it's simple as just it's got a pro-left bias. I think there are a lot of different problems. When we get to the point of the broader point about institutions, there are two things to say. One, I think there are a lot of people who would identify as progressive that would tell you institutions are rigged against them. I think if you talk to people in the Black community who in talking about police or talking about even just a couple of decades ago, the right to vote, would say the institutions are rigged against me. I think you look at the LGBTQ community would say the institutions were rigged against them. I think people on the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder, regardless of ideology, would say that the system is rigged against them. And so I tend to get frustrated when I hear people on the right simply say institutions are anti-conservative, because I think there are a lot of non-conservatives that would say, what are you talking about? These institutions have benefited your constituencies at my expense. And this is the fundamental problem. This gets right to the question of trust in institutions. 90% of the country believes that the institutions are helping everybody except them and their kind and their tribes and like-minded individuals.
You know, Mo, I love how you're describing that there, because I do feel like if we're going to think about institutions and stacking the deck against people, you've brought up a lot of examples. I mean, you know, people of color, people who are not wealthy. And Sarah, I guess I wonder, like, in terms of level of priority, like, you've often said you wouldn't want an AI bot to write a legal opinion. Like, do we really want to say it's this huge problem that if you ask Google a question, it might not be accurate? Like, I think the bigger problem might be reminding people not to trust an AI bot to answer their questions if they're important questions. Like, maybe that's what we should be talking about.
Yeah, I think that's going to be increasingly hard, though. Sort of like we already see, a younger generation that thinks if they've seen it on the internet or on TikTok, it's true. I feel like we've kind of already lost that fight. And that's why I bring up the internal institutional struggle. So can I just repeat a story of Adam Rubinstein at the New York Times?
Sure.
He was a former editor there, was pushed out after the Cotton op-ed. And so he wrote sort of a version of his story, and it included this anecdote in which at orientation, he was asked to name his favorite sandwich. Everyone was. And when it got to him, he said Chick-fil-A. And the HR representative in the room said, "We don't do that here. They hate gay people." And the comment was met with snaps of approval from others in the room. When that was published, a whole bunch of, you know, left-wing media commentator type people, said, "Never happened. Is anyone going to contact The Atlantic about the process to publish this egregiously fake anecdote?" Well, it turns out it was confirmed by multiple people who were in the room. So it absolutely happened. And Jonathan Chait over at New York Magazine pointed out something I thought was really interesting, which is, what does it say that all these people so reflexively thought the only possible answer was that it had to be fake because it was so outrageous, it couldn't possibly have happened? So if it turned out to have happened, don't you need to revisit your priors about your own institutions, that you thought it was outrageous, it turned out to be true, so maybe your institution has a problem? And that sort of second order reflection doesn't seem to happen when people notice a problem in their own institutions. And I feel like that's something that's just going to continue in every institution until we're willing to actually acknowledge that when you reflexively think that something's not true about your institution, and it turns out to be true about your institution, there then needs to be a whole nother wave of, well, wait a second.
Well, and being open-minded and saying, maybe I was wrong here. Maybe my assumptions weren't true. Maybe my institution should be questioned.
Right. Questioned. The problem is, and I feel like this is another issue we bring up often, the incentive structure right now doesn't favor questioning. The incentive structure right now favors outrage and burn it down.
So true.
Right? That's the incentive structure. And I'll give my own anecdote, one that that I was personally involved in. We hear, and Sarah talked about a perceived bias on college campuses. My institute partnered with the Associated Press last year to invite Republican presidential candidates to come to campus for conversations on foreign policy and national security. At a time when a lot of people out there are arguing conservative voices are not welcome, that college campuses are hostile. As soon as we did that, you know what happened? MAGA World went nuts. MAGA World went nuts saying any Republican presidential candidate that goes to a liberal campus like Georgetown with a liberal media outlet like the Associated Press is just a rhino and doesn't deserve a single vote. And at that point, I just wanted to beat my head against the wall, right? Like, we are trying to bring candidates here to have a conversation, which you say we are denying. Here we are actively trying to do it rather than engage. Rather that you are urging these candidates, and there was enough blowback that several candidates actually
bowed out. Get it right.
Because they didn't want to deal with that. Right? Like, don't burn it down. Get engaged.
All right. I love ending on the idea of don't burn it down. Get engaged. And get engaged, to me, doesn't have to mean be calm. Just get engaged. We are in the home stretch here. It is time to turn to our left, right, and center rants and raves. Sarah Isger, I will go to you first.
Okay, here's my rant, and maybe it touches on everything we've been saying. Super Tuesday happened this week, and I think it should tell us all something that this was the snooziest Super Tuesday in many, many cycles. We basically have two incumbents in primaries, and yet there was this feeling in the media of trying to make fetch happen. And trying to make it seem more interesting than it was, find things to pull out of it. Oh my goodness, did you see what happened in Vermont? Guys, sorry, it doesn't matter. And I think my rant is beware of the business side of media sometimes trying to make things interesting, because otherwise who's going to watch and who's going to tune in? And that maybe we need people to also, to make the opposite of Mo's point, be less engaged sometimes. It doesn't always need to be entertaining. This isn't actually reality television. Stop looking for the script to have a new excitement to tune into. And sometimes just, you know, check out and be like, okay, this primary ended a while ago, and go hug your kids.
Endorse.
I mean, to be clear, my definition of being engaged does not mean be delusional. Right? Like, I'm with you.
All right, I'm going to jump in. When I was at a doctor's office yesterday, I told someone that I host a show called Left, Right, and Center, and they said, oh, you mean, is it named after the game? And I was like, the game? No, the game is actually left, center, right. And Sarah, you actually pointed out that this game exists a few days ago, and I did not realize that it exists. But now I know it exists, and I looked into it. It's a dice game, and it's a game where you actually, you know, roll dice and determine which direction to move your chips, left, center, or right. I kind of love it. I also just saw, I went on Amazon, and the Amazon description of the game said that customers like the family use, the portability, the speed, the packaging, and the value of the game. They mentioned that it's great for family gatherings, can have many players play, and is nicely portable. They also like that the rules are so quick and easy to learn, and they appreciate the ease of use and the quality of the product. And I would just like to say that I think all of those things can apply to left, right, and center of the show as well. That's my rave. Mo, over to you. What is that noise?
Well, I had literally as I was about to start, the fire alarm in my building started to go off.
Oh, good.
I had the most brilliant rant that was going to top all rants I've ever had. But I'm going to throw it out the window now because I am going to rave about the unpredictability of doing live shows and how that's just life and we just got to roll with it.
There you go. Life in this business. Well, please save your brilliant rant for next week. All right. Mo, thank you. Sarah Isger, thank you as always. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Phil Richards. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm not sure who is producing the fire drill at Georgetown. We'll find out. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. We hope you come back next week for Mo's brilliant rant that we have to wait a week for. And you'll hear it next week on Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.